Let's
Welcome,
not boof it.
welcome to the MacGuffin Man. I'm Alex, and with me, as per usual, is James. You can check out our website, themacguffinman.com. We have recently talked about Batman v Superman, Dawn of Justice, The People v O.J. Simpson, Dawn of Non-Justice, Galaxy Quest, I'm Not There, The Verdict, and I wrote a relatively short thing about Money Monster as well. If you are a middle-aged adult that listens to this podcast, you can read that. Because everybody in that theater that I saw it in was very, very old. Anyway, so themacguffinman.com, subscribe to us on iTunes, tell your friends about us, and that's it.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Man. And now, here are Alex and James.
Oh, don't get mad. Yeah. I didn't actually see this movie.
Okay. All right, James. We are back. A streetcar, a subway, and an Uber later. We made it through the theme song, and here we are to talk about The Nice Guys.
We are.
Directed by Shane Black and written by Shane Black and co-written by a guy whose name I don't remember now that I've closed the browser window.
Anthony Pagliarazzi?
Checks out. It's cool. At least close.
Okay. Yeah, the first thing Shane Black directed since Iron Man 3?
Yes. The Nice Guys is kind of his movie where, Iron Man is currently the 10th highest grossing movie of all time. Who knows what it was at the time. It was probably like 5. You know, these lists seem to change every 2 months. And it was sort of like, I suppose Warner Brothers came to him and was just like, oh, you have made $1 billion. What would you like to do? And he said, The Nice Guys. And they're like, okay, here is a surprisingly high amount of money for this movie that it really seems like it doesn't belong in this era, you know?
Yeah, and a very Shane Black movie, correct?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, and I mean, critically, Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, the last thing he wrote and directed.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, he co-wrote Iron Man right. 3 as well.
Yeah, was very good and very critically appreciated, and a lot of similarities with The Nice Guys. You know, yeah. they're not the exact same movie, but it's not surprising that they came from the same person. And you liked Kiss Kiss Bang Bang as well, right?
Yes, I adore that movie.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so you were very much looking forward to The Nice Guys?
I was. Like, it's one of those movies where, I try and arrive late when I go to the movies just so I miss trailers. But when I did happen to be in a theater when this trailer was playing, it was one of those turn the headphones up and look at my knees sort of thing, you know? So, yes, I was very immediately sold on this movie pretty much once it was like Shane Black is making a movie off an original screenplay. You know, it's like, what's not to like for me, you know?
Yes.
And then the Gauze and Russell Crowe joined on, and I was just even more on board. Both two people I am a noted fan of, you know?
Right. And did it live up to your expectations?
Yes, it lived up to my expectations in that it was very good. You know, like it's not the movie of the year, but it's very enjoyable, and I very much enjoyed watching it, and I laughed a lot, and I think that's more than I can say for most movies.
Right. Yeah. Okay. What about it did you enjoy?
It's very funny. I mean, like, I just that's sort of like the way that, I mean, Shane Black's just one of those people that he will just, every once in a while, he'll just throw a line in there that is just amazing. Like, I mentioned this to you recently, like, the idiot joke in Kiss Kiss Bang Bang is one of my favorite moments in movie history. Like, it's so, so funny. It's, like, the line is wonderful and it's perfectly delivered. And there are a lot of good examples of that. The most notable one for me is in this movie is the repeated use of the "and stuff" joke, which I adore. And yeah, just these little things that are that are jokes but happen in the middle of scenes, like scenes that actually matter. It's not like a straight ahead comedy. There's always something going on in the scene. It's not Seth Rogen and Paul Rudd sitting in video game chairs and playing whatever game they were playing and knocked up, you know. Yeah. Or 40-year-old version, maybe that was. I don't know. Who knows? Anyway, they probably do it in both movies. Anyway. But yeah, it's just sort of like there is plot happening, but also these wonderful one-liners that are very funny, you know, and delivered with great aplomb.
Yeah, it's not so much that it's the classic kind of joke setup, punchline, move on, you know, a big comedy set piece, but it's he seems to write, you know, well-structured movies. He's been around since the 80s. And I've been listening to some interviews with him recently, you know, just because this movie's coming out, he's getting interviewed more. Mm-hmm. And he really does take a lot of pride in crafting something, and for a long time he was kind of seen as, or some people criticized him as a bit of a hack and kind of, you know, using the same formula and stuff, but it seems as though the structure of the story is very important to him, and to do a good mystery or a good thriller or you know, a good action movie, you do need to have a tight structure, so you can't spend too much time just setting up jokes for the sake of it. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I do find, especially in this, things do stay pretty tight. I mean, it is 2 hours, but we don't get scenes that are just there for laughs. It's all in pursuit of the narrative and, you know, characters chasing something or getting away from something. But yeah, you're correct, I think, in injecting some of these jokes in there without losing too much of the momentum of the story and just, you know, just kind of plugging forward with some good jokes and some good action. And I agree with you. I thought this came out as a very good kind of piece altogether, not without some flaws in it, but overall I was very pleased with it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, like, if we were to say that, like, let's say we have a radio show in the 90s, this podcast didn't exist, where we talk about movies for an hour each week, you know, like, we would be talking about The Nice Guys probably the week it came out, if it came out in the 90s, but it wouldn't necessarily be something we had to talk about, because in the 90s, these types of movies came out all the time because Shane Black wrote Lethal Weapon and kind of helped to define that genre, the buddy cop genre. And so, yeah, but now it's kind of more notable because there are so few movies like this. I mean, I think it was on the Creed podcast I mentioned, where I feel like there is this real return to sort of 90s filmmaking trends that has been happening recently, minus the best part of the 90s, which was the auteur movement that happened with PTA, Quentin Tarantino, all those guys. But like, as far as just tight, simple Hollywood storytelling, there has been sort of a return to that in a lot of movies that haven't succeeded, which is a bummer, but in some that have, you know. And The Nice Guys is another example of that sort of throwback to a style of movie I enjoyed, where this movie doesn't necessarily have a sequel. It barely sets up for one. Like, there could be one, but it doesn't set it up like it does a lot of other movies that were released in May, say.
yeah.
You know, and it's just, I don't know, it's just nice. And also, it's about humans, which I enjoy. It's an action movie about humans, which you don't get a lot of anymore.
Yeah, correct. Mm. So we talked, you know, definitely in the Die Hard podcast, and I think in a few times since then, about that being so influential. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, 80s, late 80s. And you just mentioned how Lethal Weapon kind of defined a certain kind of action movie, you know, the buddy action comedy, if you will. Mm-hmm. What's the big difference? I mean, what's the big mark that he makes, and how does that show up here?
It's been so long since I've seen Lethal Weapon that I feel like I can't really say. I also, when I first watched Lethal Weapon, I think it was like 14, and I didn't really like it. One thing that I found fun, like the only thing I remember about that movie, is that it opens with a naked woman falling out of a window, which yeah, is not that far off from The Nice Guys. But because that was, you know, that was in the 80s era of action movies, where it's just like, yeah, there is going to be a shirtless woman in this movie at some point. And I was just like, well, they're getting it out of the way pretty early in this one. So yeah, I guess I can't comment on it. And I feel like if we were to watch Lethal Weapon now, we would be surprised at, like, there would be less humor than you're anticipating. Because I remember Mel Gibson's character, I can never remember which one's Riggs or Murtaugh,
I think he's Riggs.
Yeah, okay. He's like a very... I believe when he's introduced, he's suicidal. He's like very, very close to killing himself. And so it was kind of a darker, like sadder movie, you know, where the... Like when you look at the nice guys and Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, like they're lovable losers, you know, they're not necessarily suicidal, you know, like they're down on their luck, but not like so down that they're thinking of killing themselves, you know?
Yeah. And my understanding is that his Lethal Weapon 2 script ended with Riggs dying, and that was not what they wanted for what they wanted to be a franchise.
Yeah, for sure. And yeah, and just on that note, like the thing that really got taken was from the Lethal Weapon script was that, I mean, it's the 80s. You have we've got Mel Gibson and Danny Glover, and you know, Danny Glover was the family man, and Mel Gibson was the suicidal cop who is described as a lethal weapon, you know, and they're just so different that, you know, so many movies played off of this, you know, and Rush Hour is another good example of it, even though that movie came out probably 10 years after Lethal Weapon, where you just sort of put these two differing people in an action movie, or different people, different types of people in an action movie together and write jokes about their differences, you know.
Yeah, it's kind of just a classic odd couple trope.
Yeah, exactly.
But with more guns and violence. Yeah, and I think just that comedy aspect, it seems, is important. I mean, I think Nice Guys is very heavy at times. As you said, you know, Lethal Weapon, we have a suicidal character, you know, right off the get-go. There is a lot of weight to it, and it's certainly not all played for laughs, mm-hmm. but... You know, at times it's funnier than Die Hard, and I mean this sort of little subgenre we're talking about, funnier than Die Hard, but also heavier in sort of an emotional space. I mean, Die Hard is very heavy by body count and gore, and it does have a, you know, a personal story in there, but, you know, the divorce and everything like mm-hmm. that, but there doesn't seem to be as many kind of moments of kind of personal reflection with some weight to it, the way that we find in The Nice Guys, I find.
Yeah, for sure. And like Die Hard specifically, the big revelation was that it was sort of the glass in feet scene, like despite other than that scene just being really well done, like the fact that our action hero in the 80s was in like unfathomable pain and showed it, you know, like if Rambo ran across glass, he never showed it, you know, at least not in the second or third Rambos, you know. And that was the John McClane thing, and the Shane Black thing is, as we talked about, sort of the buddy comedy sort of thing, but he also kind of bridges the gap between these sort of like these old-fashioned these characters now that are very old-fashioned, where it's just sort of like men's men, but also sort of this very 90s mindset, or something that would become prevalent in the 90s, that sort of what does anything matter, reality bites sort of vibe, you know. And I feel like that's sort of his style really bridges the 80s and 90s as far as like mentality, you know.
Yeah. So where do you think that personal weight that we were talking about comes through in The Nice Guys?
The Nice Guys, I think it all comes in Russell Crowe's desire to be a good person, and him realizing that it doesn't really matter if he is at the end. He's still, like, he might get a small victory, but he's still going to lose in the big scheme of things, grand scheme of things, and that's why he gets back into drinking. And I think it's such a downer of an ending, but like, and it's such an upbeat sort of way. And I think that's that is the main crux of the movie in that perspective, is like I really enjoyed that, you know,
just not going for the rainbows ending.
Yeah, exactly. Like they win, but what does it matter, you know?
Yeah,
he still knows he's gonna lose way more frequently. Yeah.
And it looks like two friends drinking in a bar in a Mexican restaurant having fun at the end, which seems like a good, you know, a positive ending. But there seems to be not a ton of growth from Hall and March, and we can, you know, debate that further if you wish. And there seems to be a regression in Jack Healy. I mean, this doesn't look like celebratory drinking.
He's drinking a bottle of Captain Morgan.
Yeah. You know, to see a few seconds of that scene in context, you'd think it's kind of a victory scene, but it seems to be the antithetical victory scene where the challenge of this narrative within this film has been solved and kind of conquered, but the bigger lifelong arch of this character is very depressing.
yeah, exactly. And I really love the line Gosling has, like, well, at least you're drinking again. Like, at least you understand that you have to dull yourself to this world. Like, I really enjoyed that. And I think it really speaks to the scene, you know?
Yeah, and just that idea that these two people, you know, when we first see them together, it's very, we'll say, confrontational.
Yeah.
As it involves one person breaking the other person's arm. And, you know, it ends up with them on the same side of the bar, as I said, seemingly celebrating. But Jack Healy seems to just want a drinking buddy, not to better the lives of the people around him, even the people who it seems he's endeared himself to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So let's talk about the Ryan Gosling, Holland March character.
Sure.
What do you make of him? I mean, he's kind of the, you know, you described him as a lovable loser. He's kind of the guy who lucks into a lot of things. I mean, he does show some detective skill at times, but we, you know, we're often treated to seeing him literally fall into clues or suspects and things like that, feeling he's invincible because all these people try to kill him and all these terrible things happen to him. And, you know, he ends up with his daughter being alive and no significant injuries and solving the case and getting the money. And how are we supposed to look at that?
I don't know. I really view this movie as a movie that is about, for the most part, it's more about Crow than it is Gosling. It's more about Healy than it is March, just because I feel like there is a real arc to it. Whereas maybe the reason Gosling or March has no arc is because he's kind of accepted that everything is terrible, you know, like that that his wife burned to death in their home. And he's just like, well, it's all like everything is the worst, you know, like, and he's already come to terms with it. And whereas Healy's still sort of figuring it out. And maybe that's why Gosling doesn't really have an arc. At least that's how I feel about it.
Yeah. So March's arc has gone up and down before we even meet him. And everything we learn about him is kind of retrospectively viewing his up and down. Whereas maybe we meet Healy already just in the middle or already on the way down, and this just kind of is him hitting rock bottom, essentially, even though he's succeeding in his job.
Yeah, exactly. And I feel like Healy hasn't totally given up. Like, it might be a sort of a fits and starts sort of thing where, you know, he might really drink his way through Christmas and then come back out of it on January 18th, you know, like, and be like, no, I can be good again, you know? So I don't feel like, and maybe that's happened previously in the movie or previous to the movie, you know, he really goes into a hole after his wife leaves him and then comes back out of it before this movie starts, you know? So I think it could be something that is sort of, he's going through ups and downs, and we see him on an attempted up for most of this movie before ending in a down.
Yeah, because just the way he seems to be looking upward. He talks about getting his PI license, and you know, he looks at March's house and, you know, asks him, this is what you know being a PI can pay for this. It seems he's got at least his mind set on an upward trajectory of getting a license to get a better job, to make more money, to take better care of himself. And as we see by the end, that's not exactly what happens.
Yeah, exactly. He does what he set out to do. He does something that is quote unquote good and realizes it doesn't really do all that much. You know?
Yeah, there's just another case, and you just kind of, the sun, I, you know, it's this, the only thing that's changed is that the sun is set twice kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Okay. How do you rate this among the kind of 70s Hollywood movies? I mean, you're a fan of Inherent Vice, Boogie Nights.
Well, yeah, that's, I mean, I was thinking about it today. Like, this movie really is kind of like a Hollywoodized version of Inherent Vice. Like, like, it's kind of about similar things. It kind of ends up with everything being the same as it always was, and a character sort of realizing his best days are already behind him, and the world is kind of a bummer. And even, you know, we get March's character, we get him introduced watching a commercial on TV, a commercial that ends up playing a role in the film, you know? And I don't know, that it just really felt very Inherent Vice-y. And it's interesting how similar the movies are and how different they are and how much I like them both. Inherent Vice is definitely a better movie, but I like this movie a lot. And I think it's cool that you are able to make two 70s sleuthy movies that I can enjoy so much so close together.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many kind of touchstones that kind of bridge the two of them. And, you know, to say that this is a Hollywoodized version of Inherent Vice, it's not so Hollywoodized that, you know, we get that super positive ending.
Yeah, exactly.
It hasn't been so changed over to kind of eliminate everything that made Inherent Vice interesting and just took some of the styles and, you know, some of the music and some of the plot points.
Yeah,
and just made it super accessible and, you know, friendly in a way.
Exactly. But like The Nice Guys has an ending, you know, the Inherent Vice to a lot of people is one of those endingless movies, which I disagree with. But it certainly doesn't give you a nice bow on either of the stories, finding Shasta or finding the girl whose name I don't remember now, you know. There's no real bow on the end of Inherent Vice, where there's a sad bow on The Nice Guys, but it's a bow nonetheless.
Yes, the defeat, I mean, they find Amelia, but the auto conspiracy doesn't really break their way.
Yeah, they find Amelia and she gets shot in the face.
yeah, that was a good surprising moment, though. I mean, it's not...
Oh, there's lots of little good surprises in this movie. When they are getting rid of the corpse and they throw him over the fence. Wonderful. Amelia ending up on their car. Like, this movie's funny. Like, we could spend the next 20 minutes listing all of these wonderful moments that happened in this movie. And there's just something about it that doesn't totally come together to me in the way that... Kiss Kiss Bang Bang did, or at least the first hour of Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, because I think it loses a little steam in the end, but that first hour is just amazing.
Sorry, before we get too far away from it, what do you think it is that appeals to you and appeals to screenwriters and filmmakers about that 70s era, especially for this sleuthy kind of kidnapped woman mystery thing?
Yeah, it's always fun to sort of relook at something. Like, I mean, we're starting to see it, when we've talked about it a little bit on podcasts, where we're just now seeing movies that I think the first time we talked about it was at the end of Nightcrawler, where it's very we get a shot that's very reminiscent of the Verbal Kint reveal in The Usual Suspects, where we're kind of getting to a point where filmmaking starts to reference the things that we grew up with. Like, we're getting old enough for this to happen, and that's enjoyable to me. It's interesting to me. And and I think what we're getting is Shane Black looking at the time when he grew up, and sort of looking at it from as an adult and researching it as an adult, as opposed to merely living in it as a teenager. And I think there's just something about that really connects, where somebody is looking through their own past and or how they viewed that period in the past, and translating it to a movie, even without making it a big part of the movie itself. You can sort of just... there's a feeling there that sort of translates as somebody looking back on a very formative time in their life and sketching it out in a particular sort of way. You know, and I think that's part of the real appeal with a lot of 70s movies. It's not like everybody that makes a 70s movie is in their 40s or 50s, like PTA or Shane Black, but certainly with those two movies, I think that's part of the appeal.
Yeah,
and the 70s is just kind of a fun decade to make a movie in, you know? Like, it's just
the clothes.
The clothes, the fonts on billboards and stuff, like...
Especially Hollywood, too, right?
Yeah, exactly. And Hollywood, I mean, Hollywood in the 70s is a notoriously interesting time, you know, both for the actual films and the way films were made via cocaine. Just all of those things about the 70s are just really interesting.
Yeah, and I think, as you say about kind of Shane Black looking at his own childhood, there's so many times in this movie where Holly, March's daughter, is a prominent character in this movie and acting very much like an adult. And there's so many times within this movie where we get ideas of childhood and sexuality so overlaid. I think that's part of it too. When you look at him kind of reliving his childhood, or anybody, just the idea of being a child in Hollywood at this time when the pornography boom is happening, which is featured all over this movie and very important to the plot, essentially. It's just this really interesting kind of juxtaposition of kid stuff and adult stuff, or, you know, childhood play and adult sex. There's a very clear visual one where we're at the birthday party at, you know, the child's birthday party at the bowling alley, and we see these kids playing and the reflection of the window that we're watching this very adult conversation between March and Healy, you know, discussing this woman, discussing these murders and these sex crimes and kidnappings and the pornography industry, and them teaming up together to work. And, you know, we just see these super joyful reflections in the window, and then this very serious discussion by two grown up jaded men through that same window. And to see the two images laid over each other is just one of the few times I think that those two themes are put so kind of uncomfortably close to each other.
Yeah, for sure. I would agree.
Yeah, and the same thing's done with even sex and violence as well. In that intro scene, we see, I guess we probably never get the name of that kid, Ty Simpkins, from Iron Man 3 and Jurassic World, looking at the, you know, the pornographic magazine, and he sees Misty Mountains in this kind of seductive laid out pose, you know, no clothes on, showing off everything, and then the car crashes through and he goes and sees her body, and she's still in that same pose, but, and, you know, still with a lot of her body exposed, but it's no longer seductive. It's very tragic and horrible. And, you know, she's dying. And even in that last moment, she's saying, you know, essentially a pickup line, but, you know, she's bloodied and she's seconds away from death. And just a minute ago, he was looking at this picture of her very excitedly, and now he's covering up these naked parts. And it's this really fine line between sexuality and violence, between childhood and painfully adult world. That's all over this movie.
Yeah, for sure. I would agree. And one of the things I really enjoy about the way childhood is shown in the movie it starts with Russell Crowe's introductory voiceover, Healy's voiceover, where he talks about, you know, I'm concerned about the kids, you know, like, this world is crazy and all this stuff. It's a very No Country for Old Men sort of thing. And one of the things I really enjoyed was, and one of the reason I was trying to find out if Shane Black had kids is that it's like, well, I grew up in the 70s and adults thought it was all going to shit in the 70s. And I now think it's all going to shit now in the middle of the 2010s. But maybe my kid will end up being okay, because this is just how adults think about kids pretty much all the time. And I think there's an element of truth to that, and I really enjoy it, the way that it's shown in this movie. And there's not a lot of focus on it. It's just sort of play, as you said, putting this child in these situations where you seem where that child shouldn't be, but maybe it'll still work out all right. You know, it's not necessarily the environment that's going to damn her forever. You know, it'll help, but, you know.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of comedy mined out of these moments, you know, when Holly sneaks into the party that they go to, the first kind of outing they go on together, I think. And she gets out and she sees all these women, and she says, there's whores and stuff here. And, you know, March, in his interesting parenting style, corrects the way she speaks to sound, you know, to sound a bit more elegant, but doesn't do anything, you know, to remove Anne's stuff, but doesn't remove whores or doesn't remove his daughter from this situation. And, you know, it's funny because it's a funny line, and then it also speaks to where March is as a parent, you know, so much more focused on his job than raising his daughter. And we don't know if he's kind of checked out as a parent. You know, when he lost his wife, did he kind of personally lose his status as a father, and now treats his daughter, you know, more often than not like a peer instead of a father?
Mm-hmm, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, and he's got some a couple good kind of clueless lines like that. Porno young lady, I think, is a very, very good one.
Yeah, and I mean, in his defense, he does try and keep her away from the party by keeping her in the trunk, but it doesn't work out for him.
Yeah.
For valet-based reasons.
Right. And one more thing that I really liked about sex and, you know, childhood that wasn't leaned on too hard, I thought was... really interesting. I mean, they don't do a lot with it, but just to kind of sprinkle these things throughout the surface is the motif of the birds and the bees. You know, we have these bees, you know, one particularly prominent scene featuring Hannibal Buress as a bee. And, you know, we see birds places and they're talked about and written on March's cast. And it's just a movie that's about sex, and there's no more weirdly delicate way to talk about sexuality than the term the birds and the bees, in my opinion. And, you know, just to have that really lightly leaned on, I thought just added a nice touch, because there is a lot of it. I think, you know, of this childhood / sexuality juxtaposition, if you leaned on it much harder, I think it would kind of come off as ham-fisted. But I thought that one was handled with a lot of delicacy and worked really well for me.
Yeah, for sure. And another thing I liked about that type of imagery is all the talk of smog, and just the idea that, you know, we've got our characters, Healy and March, are very, they're low to the ground. They're private eyes. They work by themselves. They don't seem to have a ton of money. And, you know, the movie is structured around finding out that to be able to be somebody at the top, to be able to be a part of the big three or something like that, you have to be able to be able to deal with this rarefied air. But this rarefied air is poisoned, you know, and you have to be able to be somebody that can deal with living in poison to be able to ascend your normalcy, you know. And I think the movie is kind of about them finding out that it's not worth it. And I think it's another way that LA adds an interesting element to the film, because it's a more spread out city than a tall city. You know, it's like if you're comparing LA and New York is goes up and LA goes, you know, east and west, you know, and just
horizontal.
Yeah. Horizontal. There you go. it stays kind of low to the ground. And I think that's kind of an interesting thing that's never really hit on all that hard. But I liked quite a bit.
Yeah, and another just great thing, 70s Hollywood. The dilapidated Hollywood sign is just such a perfect bit of imagery for this. You know, it's something that's meant to be so glorious, and to see it just fall apart. And part of it was just the timing of technologies. I mean, the porn industry blew up because you could shoot porn a lot more easily and people with less money could do it. And Hollywood had video equipment and had a constant influx of young women coming into the city, and it was kind of this perfect storm of you know, technology and geography and the myth that surrounds Hollywood, and, you know, being able to go there and make it. That I think that's part of what always appeals on a visual level about Hollywood in the 70s. I mean, that sign really was that way, and if it wasn't, I think it would be depicted that way anyway in film, but it's so perfect that I think that's another reason we find these kind of stories ending up there a lot.
Yeah, for sure. And the depiction of things that are classically wholesome in this movie is fun as well. Like, you know, when Healy and March first meet, when Healy breaks March's arm, you know, he leaves the house with an apple that he picked up, and then he meets Holly on the way to his car, and she's like, "Would you like a Yoo-hoo?" Which is
so sweet,
disgusting, sugary, chocolatey drink. And he immediately throws the apple away and is like, "Yeah, of course I want this." But it's still this sort of, it's still kind of this wholesome sort of childhood thing, even though it's now a sugar laden version of it. And also the use of the Waltons, like America's Favorite Family, and the fact that the Crispin Glover character, who is not played by Crispin Glover, but in the 80s or 90s clearly would have been
Matt Bomer.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Who I like but don't like in this movie. But the fact that he is named John Boy, like a character from America's Favorite Family, and that he is so so classically pretty and all, and is just a stone cold murderer, you know.
Yeah.
And yeah, it just goes along with what we've been talking about. This thing that is seen as nice and pretty and happens to throw little girls through windows,
very literally. Yeah. In this case, yeah, and I mean that's. We get a lot of these juxtapositions. Another one that comes to mind, not so much the childhood thing, but more the sex and violence, is when it's just that scene with, or shortly before John Boy shows up at their house, is when Amelia's lying in, I'm guessing, Holly's bed, and they're all talking to her. And again, she's kind of spread out, and, you know, she's got the shapely body with her legs showing, and it's all across the bottom of the frame, and we've seen shots like this in thousands of movies, and it's supposed to be seductive, and then she's just got a bloody, you know, gross knee. And again, it's just kind of one of those poses that we can sometimes associate with sexuality, but then there's this glaring symbol of damage and pain and, you know, the struggle that she's gone through throughout this movie and the violence that she's seen and had inflicted on her.
Yeah, for sure.
Just splitting up the image like that. Oh, you get a graduate shot.
When does it happen?
Underwater. Of course. I felt that needed to be mentioned for your
sake.
Yeah,
no, that's fine. I appreciate it. I appreciate any and all graduate references.
Did you have a take on... Okay, so that final sequence... Well, not final sequence, I guess, but the big kind of closing action sequence... which I thought was fun, kind of sprawling, but pretty fun.
Yeah.
With getting the film canister. Did you have a take on, his life, Holland Marsh's life being saved by the film canister? You know, that shot being taken straight at him and the, you know, a clear symbol of cinema being the thing that saved him?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty obvious, you know, like it was... You know, it's a little too on the nose, you know, but I assume that's how Shane Black feels about his own life. You know, like movies gave him a life, gave him a very good life, gave him a $4 million per screenplay sort of life.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know. I guess I just didn't think too much about it because it wasn't very subtle to me. You know.
Yeah. Well, that's still a reading of it. Beyond
for sure.
Everything that's there.
That's true. That is true.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's not like it was my favorite part of the movie, you know.
The whole sequence, or just kind of that one?
Well, I mean, the whole sequence, the action in this movie is not particularly well directed. I like that the action scenes are short, not because I don't think they're particularly well directed, just because I think they're, and Shane Black has talked about this, action scenes just go on for way too long now because people feel like if the action scene goes on longer, it's better, which isn't necessarily true. So I appreciate his brevity. But it's not like I was getting all riled up in these action sequences like I was with the comedy, you know?
Yeah, so, absolutely.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, the comedy of Tim Allen.
And Elaine Boozler and Richard Lewis. Yeah. Thought you'd like that.
Yeah, it was nice and prominent for me.
Yeah, it's a good time. We have to talk about the Gaz. Because
sure.
Ryan Gosling is so goddamn good in this movie.
yeah, I mean... Are we supposed to like Ryan Gosling again? I can never keep up with where culture is on him.
Oh, we've always liked him. When did we not like Gos?
I thought for a little bit after Drive, I thought he kind of fell out of favor.
Oh, that is false.
Yeah, okay.
That's a false assumption.
Well, what is it? Only God Forgives? Isn't it that era, the kind that we kind of just gloss over?
Yeah, but I mean, that's one movie that we gloss over. Like people
well,
just
March.
Ides of March, people saw it, just wasn't very good. He's good in that movie, but it's sort of when he sort of got into sort of a more comfortable sort of zone. And you can see pretty much after that movie and The Place Beyond the Pines comes out a couple of months later, he kind of really leans into starting to have fun, right? Like if you look at his career up until Crazy Stupid Love, it's all very like, I want to be Brando type of stuff, you know? And Half Nelson's the easiest thing to point to for that. But all these movies that were predicated on talking about like the ad campaign for the movie is predicated on talking about how much Ryan Gosling put into his role, you know, and then you kind of get to Crazy Stupid Love, where he's just in a rom-com and is great in that movie. And I think he sort of found out that he kind of wants to have fun, right? And so you get Drive, The Ides of March, and The Place Beyond the Pines. And after that, he pretty much just kind of has fun. The exception being, like you said, Only God Forgives, and he also directed a movie that apparently nobody liked. I didn't see it.
I didn't have fun watching Gangster Squad.
I had a lot of fun watching Gangster Squad for reasons that Ruben Fleischer may or may not have intended. You know? And then, you know, you've seen him in The Big Short and The Nice Guys now. He's next going to be in Damien Chazelle's follow-up to Whiplash, which is, I believe, a musical comedy. I think he's just kind of leaning into...
being less self-serious.
Yeah, exactly. And kind of just being where March is, like a less goofy version of March, where it's just like, well, life is what life is. You know, if I put all this effort into my role in Half Nelson, it doesn't necessarily mean that anything good is going to come of it. I could probably still be a working actor and enjoy my life more, you know, without going crazy. And I mean, he's also a father now. Those things tend to have an effect on people. I've been told children change your life. Who knows?
I had a question about that, though, because as I said, I'm not as good at keeping up with all this as maybe some people with their finger on the pulse of pop culture a bit better. But even I was, I felt kind of hyper aware of him having kids and all this kind of stuff. And I just, I guess kind of on that same note of, you know, kids change your life kind of thing. A lot of people, a lot of actors, I mean, they'd start doing more family stuff, but I think they also kind of start doing more, I don't know, like kind of idealized roles, you know, people like better role models. And for me to see this, you know, kind of the first thing I knew I've seen of his since having a kid, I guess, and him not playing a great father kind of was surprising to me. I mean, I guess if we're going to look at it through the lens of his post-childbirth film choices, I would say I was surprised by how poor his parenting was in this movie. And we don't see a big turn in it. You know, it's not like, oh, I was a bad dad for the first 80% of this movie, but then the last 20, I'm great. We don't get that, as we said, Hollywood ending where he rights all his wrongs and makes a vow to be better in a way that we're going to believe he is a good father from this point forward.
Yep. Yeah, I agree. But I mean, it was also still like he's not showing his infant this movie, you know, but at least he gets to have fun and then go home to his wife and kid or partner and kid at the end of the day sort of thing. He doesn't have to go to a bar in Brooklyn and pretend he's on crack, you know?
Yeah, let's just splice his bathroom stall scene into every movie he's
in. Oh my god, it's so good. And his
even seeing it coming, like it's in the trailers, maybe you never saw it, but I kind of like I knew what was gonna happen, and it was still so fun to watch play out.
It's amazing. And he keeps alternating which hand is opening the door or blocking the door. It's just like, I'm gonna try this another way and another way and another way, and just none of them work, and they're all so funny. The one that really got me was it's right in his introduction where he's breaking into that bar after hours. And yeah. One expertly edited sequence, like those cuts are so funny, but also his performance is amazing. Like his scheme goes off the rails.
You mean cuts from him like kind of stumbling down those stairs to screaming in the ambulance?
That stuff is great. And like I was eating a sandwich when I watched this movie. I'm like, I have never come closer to like spit taking food. It made me laugh so hard because I had no idea. I was just like, oh, okay, this is just gonna be a scene where Private Eye breaks into to this place and gets the clues that he needs, and it just immediately goes off the rails, and it's so funny. And like the only other time I can remember, like I almost choked to death on a hamburger in the first 10 minutes of Team America when I saw it. That is a true story. And I think it speaks to the quality of the first 10 minutes of Team America. But Yeah, it just made me laugh so hard. And there's a lot of, I mean, this is a very Shane Black thing of subverting the genre that that the movie exists in. And I think you get a good example of that with the ankle gun followed by the cold coffee later on. Like, those are both great, great ideas and both so funny. And that scene is pretty much perfect. And I loved both of those things. And that's a very Shane Black sort of thing. It's like, he knows he's in a genre, but he's always going to find a way to use these genre conventions in a way that you did not see coming, because you're so used to them.
Yeah.
That that you know how they're going to play out, and then they don't play out that way. Like, Kiss Kiss Bang Bang has a Russian roulette scene that is also perfect, you know? Like,
yeah. I find he kind of, it's 20% spoof, you know, he'll use these genre conventions a lot and then subvert them only, you know, 1/5 of the time.
Oh yeah.
It's not like a straight spoof where every single time you think, you know, you could say, okay, well, this is a common gag, so this doesn't work. You know, maybe the ratios are wrong, but it's not as though he does it all the time. He uses it sparingly enough that you do get a pretty good comedic payoff when they let you down.
Yeah, for sure. And like, it's just sort of this feeling that you're never able to get totally comfortable with what the movie is going to do. Like, sometimes there's a genre convention that they don't do anything with. It's just the convention. And I mean, just the basis of the movie, two lovable schlubs, you know, solving a mystery together. It's built on these conventions too, you know, and it just, yeah, you just are never allowed to get fully comfortable. Which is great. Which is great.
Well,
I don't want to be some fat cat in Detroit.
Kim Basinger, Detroit what?
Yeah, exactly. That's his little subtle 8 Mile reference.
Yeah. Shane Black, huge 8 Mile fan.
Oh, loves Be Rabbit.
anything else on the Gauz?
He's just so goddamn funny in this movie. And I think Russell Crowe is really good in this movie too. He just has sort of, he gets to have less fun. I think the scene that I will point to anybody for the rest of my life that says Russell Crowe is not funny is that quick cutaway to him having a dinner with his wife, as she says, I think she says, "I'm sleeping with your father," right?
I think she says, "I fucked your dad."
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm not saying the exact quote, but the general idea.
Sorry, Holly.
The way that he kind of spit takes and then like takes a beat and then says what? Like, it's just, it's great, like unbelievable. And I wish he had more opportunities to do something like that in this movie. Like, I would have enjoyed more of that in this movie. But I know you can't have two people going at the speed Gosling is going for the entire movie.
Yeah.
He's just a nonstop goof, you know?
Yeah. I mean, the trade-off is that the more emotionally powerful parts with Holly come from her interactions with Healy.
Yeah, for sure.
As I said there, the March or Holland and Holly stuff doesn't really get fleshed out that well. I don't mean that in a bad sense. I just mean we don't get that growth, which I think actually makes this movie kind of more interesting than it would have been if it was, you know, done in that predictable way. But I thought that they managed to find some, I don't know if necessarily fresh, but at least successful and immediate emotional stuff with Healy and Holly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It just because you're on Gosling and how good it was, the sincerity of the, you know, who else was just following orders? Hitler. that was so good to me because he kind of does have this high mindedness about him, and you know, his heart, he likes to think it's in the right place, and it's coming from a place of absolute cluelessness. And I thought he was, I was already on board thinking he was a funny person whenever he decided to be. And this just kind of illustrated that even more and made me want more funny Gosling. Even though I think dramatic Gosling's good, I'm glad he's well-rounded like this.
Yeah, for sure. And I just, I always enjoy, you know, like there's a difference between a comedian doing comedy and somebody that's got more sort of movie star gravitas to them doing comedy, you know, like it's just, there's something about it that's really enjoyable to me. And it's, you know, they're both telling jokes, like it's, you know, in an Apatow movie, say, and The Nice Guys, characters are telling jokes, but there's just a different sort of delivery and charisma involved in each, and both are wonderful. But it's much rarer to get this sort of movie star does comedy sort of thing, like Russell Crowe does comedy or Ryan Gosling does comedy, and I really enjoy it, you know, and it's great, and we have a good example of it in this movie. So
absolutely,
yeah.
Anything else about The Nice Guys?
No, I think I'm tapped out.
Cool.
Yeah. So let's go drink a bottle of Captain Morgan.
Done deal.
Thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Men. Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.